Simpson versus Battaglia, Mr. Walters.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is David Walters, and I represent the defendant appellant, Robert Simpson. Mr. Simpson is an individual without a high school diploma. His background record shows a history of psychological impairment, medical problems, attention deficit disorder, bipolarism, poor academics, and lead poisoning. Three psychologists during Pope's trial diagnosed Mr. Simpson with mental dysfunction. Two even said he was not able to comprehend sections of his trial and sentencing. Despite all this, Mr. Simpson stood before the trial judge, faced with charges of capital murder and armed robbery, and wanted to go to trial. In response to 13 requests from the trial judge about his competency and desire to represent himself, the defendant answered, "Ready for trial." Only in response to the trial judge saying, "The state will give you a quick trial," did Mr. Simpson answer affirmatively he'd represent himself. And immediately following, in response to the few competency questions that were offered, Mr. Simpson went back to his answers of ready for trial. Mr. Simpson was put to trial quickly to satisfy his wish to go to trial, not because he was competent or had waived his right to counsel. Mr. Simpson was held in contempt of court for outbursts of swearing. The judge threatened to remove him on other occasions. He accused the trial court of calling him a liar. He called the witnesses liars. He cross-examined witnesses by asking them questions like, "I'm saying that we..."
I don't understand. How can a person get his... If a person wants to represent himself and then he behaves in a bizarre and incompetent fashion as his own lawyer, how can he, by that, you know, bootstrapping, get himself a new trial? I don't get that.
Well, there's two issues here, Your Honor, and the first is whether or not he was competent or it gave an effect, a voluntary and knowing waiver of his right to represent himself, number one. And number two, the question was whether his standby counsel, as standby counsel for him, performed the most basic function of a lawyer, which was to investigate the background facts of his client.
I don't understand how a standby counsel becomes an investigator.
Well, Your Honor, the recent cases in the Supreme Court, starting with Strickland through Williams and Wiggins.
It's dual representation. You represent yourself, but you also have a lawyer representing you and conduct the investigation and so on.
No, it is not, Your Honor.
What is it you think is compelling evidence that he was in? He certainly misbehaved during the trial, but... As I say, it's bootstrapping to use that as evidence of his incompetence. What reason was there for the judge not to allow him initially to represent himself?
Well, it wasn't just his behavior after his waiver, Your Honor. It was the information.
That's what I'm asking you
right
about. What was the...
Well, the questions that were asked of him, Mr. Simpson never directly answered. What he wanted to do was to go to trial. He didn't want to waive his right to a lawyer. Only after numerous times of being asked the same question, do you want to waive your right to trial? If you were to look at Mr. Simpson's background, if the judge has conducted any investigation into his background, he would have seen a history of someone that had poor academics, someone that had various mental deficiencies. All of this came out
what
on post-trial.
Deficiency?
I'm sorry?
What mental deficiency?
As I mentioned at the beginning, Your Honor, three psychologists that evaluated him and looked into his background reported that he had issues of attention deficit disorder, bipolarism.
What does that mean? Issues of attention deficit disorder. What does that mean?
Well, he had.
Does he have it or he doesn't have it?
He did, Your Honor.
Why do they say issues?
That may have been my term as opposed to the exact term.
What do you mean by your term?
The issues of attention deficit disorder?
Yes.
I merely meant that.
What does it mean to have issues?
Your Honor, it means that he exhibited signs that he had the disease of attention deficit.
Why did you say he has the disease rather than he has issues?
Because, yeah, I misspoke, Your Honor. In addition to attention deficit disorder, these psychologists that reviewed him and his background also found that he had bipolarism, hyperactivity, poor academics, lead poisoning.
When were these evaluations made?
These evaluations were made in post-trial, Your Honor.
In what?
Post-trial, after the trial. But however, had the judge investigated...
If someone wants to represent himself, what kind of investigation is a judge required to conduct?
At the very least, Your Honor, the judge should be required to look into both his – it's a totality, not just his background, but his the behavior that he has exhibited so far. And the behavior that was exhibited up to that point included an outburst of swearing at the court and being caused to be removed from the court and held in contempt for 6 months. Beyond that, on numerous occasions, despite the judge telling him that his trial counsel was not prepared, he said, I just want to go to trial.
Can you refuse to allow someone to represent himself as a sanction?
I'm sorry?
Can you refuse to allow someone to represent himself as a sanction?
No, absolutely not. It's not a sanction.
Well, then the fact that he spent 6 months in jail for contempt, in your view, wouldn't be a ground for denying him his right to represent himself?
It's a ground of making a finding that the person is not competent to represent himself.
Why is bad behavior incompetence? I don't understand.
It's not incompetence, Your Honor. It's part of the whole test of looking into incompetence.
Why isn't bad behavior just a symptom of being a bad person?
Well, it depends if bad behavior is a result of mental deficiencies that are in your background or just because you're a bad person, Your Honor. And in this case, if the judge had asked questions about his background.
What do they mean by bipolarism? Did they mean he's actually manic depressive or what?
Well, the psychologist that evaluated him, one of them found that he was a depressive person, yes. The other psychologist that found him found that he wasn't capable of understanding what was going on during trial, and that's one of the major issues.
Was he given an IQ test?
I'm sorry?
Was he given an IQ test?
I'm sorry, I do not know that, Your Honor. Beyond the issue of incompetency, Your Honor, under any objective standard, standby counsel was ineffective.
Did he have a right to standby counsel?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has not found that there is or is not a right to standby counsel. And therefore, as the Seventh Circuit found in United States versus Windsor, they said that they knows of no right to ineffective assistance of standby counsel. But in case that right does exist, they went on to evaluate the conduct of that lawyer in that case. And in this same case, the United States Supreme Court has never found that there is no right to the constitutional there is no constitutional right to ineffective assistance.
So you can't have dual representation.
It's not dual representation.
I say you can't have dual representation.
You cannot have dual representation.
And there, we know of no particular right to have standby counsel.
The United States Supreme Court has not said that there is or is not a right to standby counsel.
Well, that would mean that there is, at least at this, as you're standing there now, no right to standby counsel.
There is none that has been recognized by the United States Supreme Court. But in the same way as in the United States versus Windsor, where this court examined that issue, there it went on to apply the test of ineffective assistance of standby counsel.
What if the defendant didn't want standby counsel?
In this case, the defendant objected to his standby counsel.
Yeah, what? Pardon?
In this case, the defendant objected to his standby counsel.
So how is it consistent with Feretta to force a standby counsel on someone?
Well, in the circumstance, especially in a case like this where there have been episodes where the defendant was held in contempt of trial, it would violate the defendant's right to a fair trial if there was no one to represent him.
Well, that's absurd. Because in that case, of course, he's not competent to represent himself. This is so half-baked, right? He's completely out of control. So instead of saying he doesn't have a right to counsel, a right to represent himself, you say he can't refuse to have standby counsel. So it's a halfway house, right?
Not at all, Your Honor. I'm saying that the waiver that he made in this case of his right to counsel was
know that, but if we go past that and say
yes.
No, he was able to represent himself, then isn't he able to say I don't want to stand by counsel?
I'm sure that he could say that, Your Honor. But beyond the fact of whether he could say that would be whether or not it would be protecting his right to a fair trial in order to
Well, that's why you don't get it. If the person is competent to represent himself, he should be competent to waive standby counsel.
Right, but in this case, the defendant was not competent to waive his right to counsel in the first place. I see my time
is... Yeah, you want to save your time?
Yeah, I'll save
okay,
that last one.
Thank you, Mr. Walters. Ms. Lobby?
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, my name is Claire Labbe from the Attorney General's Office, and I represent the respondent. Petitioner certainly was difficult at the beginning of trial, but his pretrial proceedings gave the trial court a good indication of how he could handle himself and understand the proceedings. The first time he appeared before the trial judge at arraignment, he did have an outburst. And while that outburst was certainly inappropriate and ill-advised because it resulted in contempt, it was not irrational. The defendant subsequently, once he had waived counsel in a discussion with the trial court, wanted to apologize to the trial court for his actions, which he then understood were inappropriate. He explained that he was frustrated, he had been in jail, he hadn't had contact with anyone. He got to court, there was no lawyer there. He wanted to speak to his two co-defendants. The trial judge refused his request. The petitioner thought he was being disrespected. They got into an argument. He cursed at the judge, and the judge cited him with contempt. Petitioner was removed from the courtroom, but was able to come back that same day once counsel arrived. He was able to behave himself, and he was able to behave himself throughout the entire trial court proceedings. It was only 6 months after he was convicted and sentenced during post-trial proceedings that he had his second outburst, which occurred when the prosecutor brought to the trial court's attention the petitioner had falsified a motion to withdraw a guilty plea for a co-defendant, and that he had falsified the co-defendant's signature as well as the notary signature. And the petitioner responded in anger and called the prosecutor a liar. Again, inappropriate, but not irrational. He understood the import of what he was being accused of. The trial court was also able to observe the petitioner's actions throughout trial and able to see that he was able to comport himself and that he was able to understand the proceedings, take in information, request appropriate information through discovery, and make appropriate motions and arguments.
Had the defendant been through trials before?
The defendant had an extensive felony history, Your Honor, and he was 39 years old. He understood the legal process. He understood how felony trials work. This case was slightly different, as this was a capital case, and the petitioner had never been involved in that. But in order to overcome that, the trial court very explicitly explained to petitioner what the circumstances were for a capital sentencing hearing, that there would be no time between a conviction, if that's what his trial resulted in, and the sentencing hearing, and months before trial commenced, encouraged petitioner to go ahead and seek mitigating evidence in the event that he would need to go on to sentence. So petitioner was fully aware of that possibility. As for the psychologist who interviewed defendant 4 years after trial, their diagnosis, they all said that their diagnoses were speculative. They would not make a definitive diagnosis without some medical testing, which never occurred. And furthermore, there were three doctors, Dr. Stein, Dr. Hess, and Dr. Gunn. And their descriptions of defendant's behavior does not logically match up with their recommendation as to what mental disorders they thought he suffered from, which is what the post-conviction circuit court found. And furthermore, their findings and description of defendant 4 years post-trial do not comport with defendant's behavior at trial. For example, the doctor said that petitioner had difficulty focusing, that he had rapid speech, impulsive decision-making, and an apparent inability to fully comprehend the mitigation process. The petitioner extensively cross-examined and on direct examination was able to show his focus and to keep moving through with his points. The record doesn't reflect that any witnesses or the court were unable to understand petitioner due to the speed of his speech. Petitioner spent a year preparing for trial, during which he managed discovery and witness preparation, which counters the psychologist's finding of impulsive decision-making. Furthermore, Dr. Hess diagnosed petitioner with anterograde amnesia, which is the inability to remember recent events. And this is also contradicted by the record, as petitioner was able to consistently recall what had happened at the previous hearing, as well as being able to recall specifics about his arrest when questioning witnesses. So petitioner's medical evidence does not establish that he was not competent to waive counsel because it doesn't show that he wasn't able to understand the proceedings. Furthermore, petitioner did have a knowing and voluntary waiver. The trial court informed him of the nature of the charges against him, the possible penalties involved. The trial court repeatedly suggested that petitioner retain counsel, stating that it was not a wise thing to do to represent oneself. The trial court explained that he had seen it done and that it was possible, but that from his experience, petitioner would be better off with appointed counsel, and specifically pointed to petitioner's appointed counsel that he had been involved in many cases of this magnitude, and that he was very able and well-versed to help petitioner through this process. The trial court also extensively described the role of standby counsel and the limitations that it would come with. He described that petitioner was solely responsible for his representation. He even gave him a case to read from the Illinois Supreme Court where the Supreme Court lays out what happens when there's standby counsel. And specifically say that he didn't want to give petitioner any false security about the presence of standby counsel. The petitioner would be the individual responsible for all decisions made in his defense. The admonishments and discussions between petitioner and the trial court when petitioner was waiving his right to counsel were extensive because petitioner did initially just keep repeating, "I just want to go to trial, I just want to go to trial." But the trial court didn't merely accept those statements. He kept probing. And when petitioner wouldn't answer him, he would move on to a different take, describe another part of the proceedings, and come back until petitioner did definitively say, "Yes, I want to represent myself. I'm waiving my right to counsel." Petitioner came to court the next day. And again, before they did anything, the trial court said, "I'd like you to take a moment. I'd like you to talk to standby counsel and make sure that this is what you want to do." The trial court also said that if petitioner began the process of gathering evidence and discovered that perhaps he didn't want to represent himself, the trial court would be willing to reconsider its decision. He did warn him that he wouldn't allow him to do this on the eve of trial as a delaying tactic, but he did leave that option open to petitioner. Petitioner took the trial court up on his advice. They put the case aside. Petitioner spoke to standby counsel, came back to the trial court, and said that, yes, he definitely did want to represent himself. So this was a knowing and voluntary waiver.
How long was this before the start of the trial?
This was about a year. I believe this happened in about June of 1992, and he wasn't convicted until June of 1993. And although petitioner did initially just keep repeating, I want to go to trial, I'm demanding trial, he did demand trial, and they did start the speedy trial requirements. But when it actually came to the date on which they would have had to go to trial, petitioner didn't have all the evidence that he wanted to present in order to impeach witnesses. So he asked for a continuance. And that's how the case proceeded for a year. So the petitioner was able to understand the importance of needing to gather evidence, and he had a plan, and that he executed that plan during pretrial proceedings. Petitioner has claimed that his standby counsel was ineffective during sentencing. The Supreme Court has not recognized a constitutional right to standby counsel, and therefore, under 28 U.S.C. section 2254 D1, that right cannot be enforced for the first time during habeas corpus proceedings. Mm-hmm. If there are no further questions,
thank you very much, Ms. Mr. Walters, how much time does he have? 1 minute.
Your Honor, in Pate v. Robinson, the Supreme Court said that a defendant's demeanor cannot be relied on to dispense with the very right of a competency hearing. What it can be relied on for is to determine whether or not he actually was incompetent or not. The defendant,
you're not saying a competency hearing is required to determine any time somebody wants to represent themselves?
I am not, Your Honor. But I'm saying in this case, given the background of this defendant, had it come to light. In fact, the trial court, as appears on the record, never even learned
I don't understand you. What kind of investigation does the judge have to conduct before he can allow someone to represent himself?
Well, there would be several things, Your Honor. The first thing would be to determine his level of education. The first thing. In this case, the trial court never even learned that he hadn't completed high school. In the second case, it would be determined the way the defendant has held himself out so far in court. And as evidenced by the record, not just his outburst, but on numerous other occasions, the court was required to ask him to restrain himself or he would be held in contempt. In addition to his demeanor in court, the third thing that you can look at is what his prior background is and what his history of mental illness, if there is any.
Well, now, wait a second. I mean, how far are you going to go with this investigation? How is the judge supposed to find out what his history of mental illness is?
Well, I mean, he can ask him certain questions about his background, Your Honor. And beyond that, if there are other factors pointing up to it, for example, his demeanor in this case and his education, if it had even come to light, then he could have ordered him to be analyzed by a psychologist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Walters. And you were asked to represent Clark.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, we thank you for your vigorous efforts on his behalf. And the court will stand in recess now.